Okay.
Done with that. Now I can get to the fun part of the week, which is the science podcast. I'm Christopher Joyce, and I'm a reporter on the Science Desk. And one of the things I like to hear about and write about are old dead things. And we're in luck this week because NPR science reporter Joe Palca has written an interesting story about a woolly mammoth, or many woolly mammoths, actually. And there's a scientist who collected hair from woolly mammoths that were frozen in the Siberian tundra. And he's talked to them about what they discovered and what could happen in the future. So here's Joe Palca.
Let's say you study ancient DNA and you're lucky enough to stumble across a woolly mammoth's remains in the Siberian permafrost. The mammoth's been dead for thousands of years. A reasonable first question is, where the heck do you get some DNA from? Well, it turns out one very good place to get DNA from is hair.
Unlike what you hear on CSI, you don't need to have a hair follicle to find DNA attached with hair. We isolate the DNA from the hair shaft.
Stefan Schuster is at the Pennsylvania State University.
The problem with mammoths, as it is with all ancient DNA, is there's always a large amount of DNA that is contaminating the DNA that is coming from the organism that you want to study.
Even in the Siberian permafrost, where the extinct mammoths Schuster studied came from, ancient samples are covered with DNA from bacteria and viruses and the like that may once have lived in or on mammoth remains. But Schuster says there's a way to deal with contaminating DNA in hair.
The way that we get rid of it is that we shampoo and bleach the hair on the outside.
Not only does this make the hair soft and manageable, but what's left inside the hair shafts is almost exclusively mammoth DNA. Schuster says the DNA is not the long strands found in living cells. Instead, it's millions of tiny fragments. But new sequencing machines can read these fragments, and new computer programs can stitch together the fragments to form a complete sequence, or at least a nearly complete sequence. Tom Gilbert also studies ancient DNA. He's at the University of Copenhagen. He says reaching this sequencing milestone was expected.
I'm not surprised, no, because I've seen the developments that have been happening all along. That's not to say it's not a fantastic achievement.
Now, it's tempting to speculate that with the DNA sequence in hand, it might be possible to recreate an extinct mammoth using a mixture of genetic engineering and cloning. Maybe. But Gilbert is skeptical, at least in the short term.
I should warn up front that I have a history of saying it's not possible, and then within months some technological breakthrough comes through that makes me revise my opinion.
Gilbert says the real value of having the sequence data is that it will help scientists understand how elephants evolved.
Elephants, they live in warm climates, they live, you know, Asia, Africa. The mammoth is related, but it was living up in the cold. How did it do that? You know, what changes did its body have to go through to do that genetically? And they can start to investigate these changes and sort of find out, you know, essentially look at evolution in action.
Penn State's Stefan Schuster says he and his colleagues have already made some headway in understanding the differences between modern elephants and mammoths by comparing their DNA.
Mammoths and elephants are, on the sequence level, very similar. 99.4% is identical between the two.
But in that 0.6% difference, they've found areas that may hold the key to how animals adapt to the cold. They also found something interesting when they looked at how elephants were evolving compared with primates like apes and humans.
We compared the rate of evolution in the primate lineage and in the elephant lineage, and we found that the evolution was twice as fast in the primate lineage.
So things were happening more rapidly in human evolution than in elephant evolution.
That is for sure, yes.
Although faster shouldn't be confused with better. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Well, that was a fun story, but every story has bits and pieces that didn't make it in. Outtakes, I guess you call them. And in doing his interview for this story, Joe wanted to know what else scientists can get DNA from. And here's an answer that didn't make it into the story from Brian Kemp from Washington State University. He's a scientist who studies coprolites, otherwise known as fossilized feces.
Oh, yeah, I'm having great success. But, I mean, poop is my business now. It's amazing because the preservation is really good, and no one objects to the study of them presently, so that you can destroy coprolites and nobody really cares.
It's not like an ancient bone that's rare that you have to drill into to get DNA. There seems to be a fair amount of this stuff around, and you know, everybody who makes poop leaves DNA behind, whether you're a T-Rex or whether you're a Homo erectus. And it does have a lot of interesting information. And while we're on the subject, outtakes and fossilized poop, that is. Here's another piece of interview tape that was left on the cutting room floor that seems a little relevant to me now because we've witnessed this month National Toilet Day. I got the Duffy walking by saying National Toilet Day.
Hey, Brian.
What are you guys doing?
We're doing a podcast.
Are you cool?
We're using Joe Palca's story about coprolites, fossilized feces. Well, actually, that was part of his story, to segue into National Toilet Day.
You're just a font of useful knowledge, aren't you?
Brian Duffy is managing editor.
I'm managing just fine today. Tomorrow may be a different story.
Well, Brian always comes by the science desk when he wants answers.
And I usually find them. Usually, not the answers I've expected, but I usually find very interesting answers at the science desk. So it's always a pleasure.
Okay, let me get back to National Toilet Day now. We've witnessed this month National Toilet Day. The organization that is putting it forward, called WaterAid, is trying to tell people how serious it is around the world, it being the lack of water for everything from agriculture to drinking to having sanitation. And in fact, the United Nations has called 2008 the International Year of Sanitation. But it reminded me of... I need to get that. Hi.
Okay. Bye.
Where were we? It reminded me of an interview that I did in England with Martin Palmer and Victoria Finley. They both run the Association of Religions and Conservation. And we were on the way to work talking about conservation, and we stopped all of a sudden because they needed to point out something very important and historically relevant to our discussion today in an empty field just outside the city of Bath.
That is the site of a historic invention, an invention that has transformed the homes right around the world, including, I would say, almost every home in America. That is the field in which was the house where the first flushing toilet was invented.
1597.
And his name was Crapper.
No.
It was invented by John Harrington, Sir John Harrington, who was one of the favourite godsons of Queen Elizabeth I.
So nobody does a Harrington any longer. They used to.
And he lived here, and he obviously thought about how he could improve his own sanitary and living conditions.
In fact, you can see where the pipe used to come out past the churchyard.
Well, is there a plaque or something in bronze to commemorate this?
No, there isn't. I mean, it's well known, and if you go into the village pub here, I suppose you could say this used to be the seat of the Harringtons, but apart from that, but if you go into the local pub here, they've got all the details on the wall. I mean, a description, that is. I don't...
Well, we'll watch where we step. We've just been listening to the story of how the toilet was invented, and that makes us think about water and where water goes. And so we're sitting around at the NPR science desk and thinking about something else, which is what happens to the ocean when we put too much carbon dioxide into it. And it so happens I'm sitting here with Richard Harris.
Hi, Chris.
How are you doing, Richard? Well. And we're going to talk about carbon dioxide because Richard's been writing about it and knows something about some of the effects it's having on the ocean.
Yes, indeed. Well, carbon dioxide is a gas. It actually will go into the ocean. The gas in the atmosphere actually soaks into the ocean. In fact, quite a lot of the carbon dioxide we put into the air goes into the ocean, about half of it. So that's good. The world is not heating up as fast as it otherwise would because a lot of this carbon dioxide is going into the ocean. Unfortunately, the bad news is when it goes into the ocean, some of it turns into carbonic acid, and that is making the ocean relatively more acidic. And scientists have noticed this over the past decade or so, and they're starting to realize this is a really big deal because there are lots of animals in the ocean that don't like too much acid, and they're starting to see the effects of this.
So what I had always heard was that the main effect of this is coral reefs. Coral reefs are taking the hit here.
Right. Scientists early on focused their attention on coral reefs, plus some other plankton that actually are very carbon sensitive and that fish feed on, and so we care a lot about the plankton too. But it turns out that this is a problem that's striking a lot closer to home. There have been a couple of studies just in the last year or so showing that that the waters off the Pacific coast are starting to get more acidic. One reason that this is a big concern is... a lot of shellfish, corals, shellfish, other animals actually take carbon out of the water to build their shells. If the acid level in the ocean changes too much, the carbon flows in the other direction. It goes from the shells out into the water, and it makes the shells weaker and weaker, and ultimately could make things like corals dissolve.
Well, let's look at the past. Throughout geologic time, the acidity of the ocean and the warmth of the ocean and even the level of the ocean has changed lots of times. You know, animals adapt. Can't animals now adapt to more acidity in the ocean?
Well, the ocean will be very different from what we are accustomed to. Obviously, some animals will suffer. Others probably wouldn't mind the change in acidity. But we care about mussels. They are the foundation of the coastal ecosystems off the coast of California, for example. We care about coral because coral builds coral reefs. And yes, there have been times when the ocean water has been apparently even more acidic than we're seeing right now, according to the geologic record. And what scientists think happened actually was corals went into a form where they basically weren't building their little skeletons and weren't creating reefs. The organisms may have managed to survive as sort of free-floating little animals, but they weren't building reefs, and the environment was very different.
And, of course, anytime you change one part of the ecology, you know, there's a ripple effect. So even if one organism can adapt, it's going to change, which means that all the other animals that depend on it have to adapt as well.
That's true. And the other thing to remember is this is not the only stress we're putting into the oceans right now, the carbon dioxide. It's on top of the fact that many, many fisheries are being overfished right now, that we're putting far more nutrients into the ocean and changing the ocean chemistry from runoff from farms and so on. We're doing a lot of things that are stressing the ocean. And this is just one other element to it that, you know, is just, you know, happens to be on a global scale, but is bad too.
Richard, do you have any good news?
Yes, it's almost lunchtime.
Thank you, Richard. And finally, we couldn't let this week go by without deference to the turkey, since it is Thanksgiving week. So we're going to hear from Nell Greenfield Boyce about people called flexitarians, that is, cheating vegetarians.
Wayne Pacelli is head of the Humane Society of the United States. He's a vegan, which means he eats no animal products. But when he goes to spend Thanksgiving with his family...
There will be some turkey that others eat, and there's nothing I can do about that.
Most vegetarians are used to this kind of social situation. Meat is everywhere. But Thanksgiving is a little different.
You know, I don't think there's any other American holiday that is quite so associated with killing an animal for the table.
Pacelli says a roasted animal carcass isn't tempting for people like him who are committed to vegetarianism, but he says...
You know, there is a large category of people who are eating less meat than they used to, called flexitarians. And I'm sure that among that group of people, this may be a day where they choose to eat some meat.
Flexitarians are part of a growing trend of people generally thinking harder about meat, whether or not to eat it, and if so, what kind is okay. Turkeys can wander around a roomy pasture at Springfield Farm in Sparks, Maryland. Every November, hundreds of people come here to pick up their holiday meal.
I'm David Smith, the owner of Springfield Farm.
And can you tell me sort of what your typical customers are?
I think it's more the issue of people looking to connect with their food, to put a face on it, if you will. Their concerns are local, what the livestock is fed. They want it as natural as possible, and how the livestock is treated, not only on the farm, but also how it's slaughtered.
Those kinds of concerns are why some people just won't eat mass-produced meat.
I stopped eating meat not because I'm against devouring it, but because I didn't like where it was coming from.
That's Jenna Wogenrich. She lives on a small farm in Vermont. She's written a new book called Made from Scratch that describes how she grows her own vegetables.
I've been a vegetarian for over half a decade.
At her family's Thanksgiving, she usually eats tofu instead of meat. But this year, she decided to prepare for the holiday by raising her own turkey. She bought a little bird. He soon became a big white one.
Well, I didn't name him. I made sure I didn't name him, and he was great. I mean, he got along great with the chickens and with all the other farm animals.
She drove him to a nearby farm to have him killed and stored his body in her freezer. But then she ran into a problem. She says some meat-eating members of her family didn't want to consume a known animal.
The turkey situation was a big lesson for me because you go into it way, way too self-righteous. There's a whole spectrum to this, and there's a million different viewpoints, even within one family.
She ended up trading the turkey with someone who agreed to teach her dog to herd sheep. I called up the Farm Sanctuary in New York State. It's a farm animal protection group that runs animal shelters for livestock, plus an Adopt-a-Turkey project. Trisha Berry works there. I asked her what she thought about people who call themselves vegetarians but still plan to eat animals on special occasions.
Who am I to judge or criticize someone for, you know, their journey and their path, whatever it might be?
After all, she says, she herself went through a period of cutting back on meat. But she didn't quit cold turkey until she actually met a turkey, a bird called Cinnamon.
And I actually gave her a belly rub, and she rested into my hand, and I felt, you know, this living, breathing, alive turkey breast.
It reminded her of another turkey breast, the one she'd cooked for Thanksgiving the year before. She says that was the moment when she knew she had to switch from eating less meat to eating no meat. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
So that's it for this week's podcast. From the Science Desk, I'm Christopher Joyce. And we can't end the week without mentioning, of course, that it's Thanksgiving week. So keep in mind that the average American eats 900,000 calories a year, and that you'll eat half of those between now and the new year. So let's go to lunch.